Folks, it's springtime, and this week's special at drhoffman.com is Core Restore, a one-stop shop for your detoxification needs. That's Core Restore. Look for it at drhoffman.com and come browse our full selection of great products at drhoffman.com. Click on the store. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it's that time of week again, your favorite time of the week, because today is Q&A with Layla. It's an opportunity for you to pose your questions, and when we get your questions, we respond to them via podcast. So here today with us is Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin. For those of you not familiar with Layla, she and I work together on a daily basis at the Hoffman Center, and she is a registered dietitian who has gone on to take advanced studies in nutrition with a master's degree in that field. And hello, Layla, how are you?
Great, Dr. Hoffman. How are you doing?
Good, good. So once again, here we sit unexpectedly. It's almost mid-March. And what was the temperature this morning? It was like 10 degrees or something.
10 degrees, negative 4 degrees with the wind chill.
Unbelievable.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay. So, however resolutely we will podcast, we're nice and warm inside, and we will be answering your questions. Last week, we had to do some damage control on a study that suggests that eating animal protein specifically, is as bad for you as cigarettes. So every time you sit down and have a steak, it's like puffing on 3 or 4 Pall Mall cigarettes.
That's ridiculous.
Okay.
It is just completely ridiculous. But count on the media for all kinds of hype.
Exactly.
So
a little background on that. Actually, we talked about that on Intelligent Medicine on the radio show this weekend, and we uncovered some of the flaws in that study. But of interest was that this week, you know, this is why our job is so perplexing, because it's kind of like being an air traffic controller. You know, it's like out of control airplanes near collisions, and we have to keep on our toes and call it. There was this week a study that suggests that additional protein for older individuals is very beneficial. It extends life and can reduce the risk of all manner of diseases. And that included the dread animal protein.
Yeah, yeah.
So if it's so bad for you, how come it's so good for you?
Well, it's not bad for you. That's the fallacy is it's bad for you is the fallacy. It is absolutely good for you. We've known for many years that older people do better with increased protein. The RDA for protein should actually be doubled for people over a certain age. I would say over 50 or over 60 so they don't get sarcopenia.
Right, because that's a common cause of the downhill course for older individuals. And also older people, you know, their teeth are not so good, their digestion gets a little weak, their appetite is decreased. Sometimes they're on these medications that suppress appetite.
That's true.
And people waste away. And, oh, by the way, you know, often I'm walking down the street and I look in the window of an ice cream parlor or something like that, and I see like an older seasoned citizen sitting there. Sometimes in this weather, an older lady who trots out her mink coat circa 1955, puts it on to go to the ice cream parlor and have an ice cream sundae.
Oh, how fun.
Because, but that tastes really good. You know, older people have funky taste buds, and they have different taste preferences, and they tend to go for the fireworks. They tend to go for sweets and sugary foods.
Yeah. The other thing is it becomes easier. As people get older, I've seen, and they become more feeble, they're relegated to a diet of tea and toast.
Yeah.
And that just adds, you know, more to the downward spiral.
Well, the tea might have some beneficial polyphenols,
yeah.
But the toast doesn't do it.
But the toast isn't, yeah, exactly.
Right. So what is interesting is that the guy who wrote this article, he's actually an interesting guy. His name is Walter Longo. with like a V, vault like Walter with a V, and he's at USC, and he's kind of a big shot in the field of nutritional research. And it's interesting that his research got translated to protein is bad for you and that protein is as bad as cigarettes. Because actually, he has a different focus on his research. A lot of his research is on the field of cancer. And to be fair to him, his research is quite interesting because what he has demonstrated is if you have cancer and if you take chemotherapy, it's not a bad idea to virtually fast, to eat very lightly, to eat very low calories. Because, and this makes sense because excess food is kind of fuel for cancer. And so eating very lightly if you have cancer makes a lot of sense. I mean, this idea has been around for a long time. People going to, you know, that place, Ann Wigmore, you know, with the juicing. You know, you go to this retreat and you juice and you juice and you juice and you eat very little, in fact, but you get plenty of phytonutrients from vegetable juices. Or the macrobiotic diet, which is actually pretty low in calories, but may be beneficial for certain cancers. I've seen it work in some cancer patients, particularly men with prostate cancer, sometimes women with breast cancer do very well on a macrobiotic diet.
Now, all of this goes against the advice given by people at Sloan Kettering and everywhere else of, oh, no, don't lose weight.
Yes.
They're terrified of the patient losing weight, which becomes a problem. So what they tell them to eat is more calorically dense food, and that means
Ensure.
Ensure. Ice cream.
Yes.
Boost.
Whatever you want.
Sugar.
Yeah.
More sugar.
Keep that weight on.
Yeah.
And partly, it's not reassuring to see a cancer patient lose weight. I mean, it looks like you're checking out. And it freaks out the relatives, and it, you know, the doctors encourage people to maintain that weight. And no, we don't want people to starve. So coming back to this guy, Walter Longo, I'm going to try and see if I can hook him into a podcast, one of our Intelligent Medicine podcasts during the week. I've extended an invitation to him. He has developed a line of foods that are phytonutrient rich, but calorically restricted and protein restricted, which he's going to sell to the cancer marketplace. And I think it's actually going to be a blockbuster medical food. I think it's really going to be...
That's terrific.
Yeah. So it's interesting that he is... That principle may apply to people with cancer or particularly people undergoing chemo. Because what he says is that if you restrict your caloric intake while you have chemo... the cancer cells will be more vulnerable to the chemo. And in addition, your regular cells will be more resistant to the ill effects of the chemo. And that's kind of cool.
Yeah. What I think is most interesting about that is he's almost inducing a state of ketosis to some degree so that you don't feed the cancer. And then you send in the soldiers of chemotherapy to knock it out. It kind of makes sense from a common sense standpoint anyway.
It's a synergistic approach.
Yeah.
And also more and more cancer practitioners are adopting this approach. They're telling patients to eat a low-calorie, low-carbohydrate diet, not necessarily high protein, but a diet that is light, shall we say. And they combine it with conventional therapy. Sometimes they combine it with oxidative therapies like hyperbaric oxygen, using anti-cancer agents to more rapidly kill the cancer. And so it's interesting because a lot of these views are coming together, and what gets lost are these lurid headlines that encourage everyone not to eat protein. And oh, by the way, everybody's protein requirement is different. So I, for example, you know, I swim, you know, maybe 2-3 times a week. I'll swim, you know, a mile or mile or two. I'll run. I'll cycle long distances. That's a lot of wear and tear on the body. On a low-protein diet, that wouldn't work.
No, no, not at all.
And, you know, in addition, I think what we're achieving some consensus about is that a high carbohydrate diet is very deleterious to the vast majority of people. So telling them to eliminate protein, which is a source of satiety, you know, you got to eat something. So then you gravitate to the carbs.
Exactly.
That ain't good. Yeah. That ain't good. So it's one of those, the messaging in the media is so bad.
That it's atrocious.
We're slapping our foreheads all the time here. You know, it's like... Okay, so We'll be talking more about this theme. Maybe we'll crank out an article or two. We'll continue with interviews on this subject. So without further ado, let's get to our questions of the week.
Okay, I've got one, Dr. Hoffman. This is from Akia. I love your show. My father has sickle cell anemia and often has aches and pains. On a past podcast, you mentioned fish oil and CoQ10 are great supplements to aid in the sickling of the blood cell that causes clotting and pain. My question is, are there a specific food or a diet that would help my father? He's 58 and a chef.
Wow.
So he's always on his feet, and when I try to get him to work out or get active, of course he's tired and often in pain. Thank you for mentioning sickle cell. It is often forgotten about and rarely touched upon. Thank you.
Well, yeah, one of the problems with sickle cell is that it truly is it's a minority disease.
Yeah.
It's a disease that affects African Americans almost entirely, and so it may not achieve as much mainstream attention. But boy, during my training, which was in the Bronx, I went to Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and our teaching hospital there was Jacoby. We had tons of patients with sickle cell, and they were in terrible shape. They were all addicted to painkillers because it's so, and not because they were junkies, but mm-hmm. because it's such a painful condition. So after so many bouts of strong opiate medications, they were all addicted. So, yeah. You know, you get this, and there's a little bit of an inherent racism in this because you get these African-American patients who come in, and they don't look well. Mm-hmm. They look kind of beat up and unwell, and they come in demanding painkillers. And so you're saying, like, what's up with this? Is this person just trying to get high, or are they in really serious pain? And this presented a dilemma for us in the management of these patients. They were genuinely in pain. They would be very happy not to get a street high from these medications, but they were hooked on these medications. So it's a terrible, terrible problem. It's a condition where literally the blood cells, which are round, everybody knows what a red blood cell looks like. It looks like
round and concave.
Round and concave. It looks like a donut. Or as we were taught at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, we were taught that they were bagel-shaped.
Mm.
Seems a very, not all Jews there, but a lot of Jewish medical students. So when they sickle, they get literally like a crescent moon shape.
Yeah.
And they don't flow as well. Like round little donut-shaped cells pass well easily through small blood vessels, but mm-hmm. they clump together when they sickle. And this causes what are called sickling crises. And then there's a lack of oxygen to critical areas of the body, the extremities particularly, and you get extraordinary pain because of ischemia, lack of oxygen, blood flow. So anyway, as I mentioned, and this listener is very astute, fish oil has been shown to help sickle cell dramatically, and it would be an easy thing to do to give all sickle cell patients the recommendation that they take 6 capsules a day of fish oil, like a lot of fish oil, mm-hmm. because it acts as kind of like a lubricant. You know, okay. If you want to get an object through, you know, a small narrow passageway, you put a little lube in there, and right. that's what fish oil does in effect. Fish oil also helps with the flexibility and distensibility of the walls of the red blood cells, so mm-hmm. that they're more flexible and not as jagged. I didn't realize this until I saw the study, coenzyme Q10 may help because the energetics of these cells may be impaired in sickle cell anemia. So when it comes to, and I would recommend that people take ubiquinol, maybe invest in high doses of ubiquinol, mm-hmm. like 300 milligrams a day, mm-hmm. which is not easy for some of these patients. Many of these patients can be poor. I'm not necessarily stereotyping, but it's really an inner city problem. And it would be great if these supplements were covered. Yeah. You know, they can take tons of medication, but the supplements aren't covered, and that's mm-hmm. unfortunate. When it comes to diet, I don't know what to say about diet, except, you know, good diet is going to help.
Sure, a good diet is going to help. I imagine in light that fish oil would be beneficial. You want to stay away from processed food, trans
sure.
fats, all of that.
Sugars.
So it's not competing yeah. with the omega-3s and the fish oil.
Right.
Because they will compete for for their place on the phospholipid membrane and the membranes of the red blood cells. And
by the way, something I'm noticing with our patients is that in the past we had a test that measured omega-3s in the bloodstream. And what we found is that many of our patients had low omega-3, and some of our patients had seemingly normal levels of omega-3. Mm-hmm. But a new test is giving us even more insight because they're giving us an omega-3-6 index, which is the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6. And what we're finding is that some patients who seemed on the previous test had an adequate omega-3, when you show how much omega-6 they have, that omega-6 is competing with the omega-3, and it causes the ratio to be suboptimal. So you want people to have a ratio of 7, 8, 9, 10, and a ratio of 4 or less is not a happy ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's two ways you can fix your ratio. One is take them more omega-3s, but also you have to reduce your omega-6s.
Absolutely.
So where do you get omega-6s in the American diet?
We're getting omega-6s from vegetable oils. We're getting omega-6s
like salad dressing,
shortenings. You know, the soybean oil, cottonseed, canola, all of these are not great sources. The other thing is from our factory farmed animals.
Animals. You are what you eat. Mm-hmm. And the animals that forage on basically, you know, they eat synthetic food, the specially prepared cheap feeds that are really, you know, a lot of the soy goes into animal feed.
Mm-hmm.
So they're getting a lot of omega-6 oil into their flesh. We eat their flesh. We get a lot of omega-6.
Yes.
And the meat seems okay. I mean, you know, doesn't seem to, you know, bother us that taste-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And the fat looks like regular fat, but it's fat that's rich in omega-6, not omega-3.
Exactly.
And if you eat grass, especially northern grass, the further north you are, you know, the northern grasses of, you know, the Dakotas,
mm-hmm.
the further north you are, the more omega-3 is in the grass.
Is that right?
Yeah, because omega-6 is more of a tropical oil, and omega-3 is a more of a Nordic or northern oil.
Uh-huh.
So that's actually why Canada is, you know, not that much omega-3 in canola oil, but a little bit of omega-3. That's a Canadian rapeseed.
Mm-hmm.
Also, nuts from northern climes are better for you, like walnuts, mm-hmm. which grow more in temperate climates, and pecans, as opposed to peanuts and macadamia mm-hmm. nuts and things like that. Those are more rich in omega-6. Sesame is very rich in omega-6. So there's another article. It's very, very interesting this week. It comes to mind. I know we're talking about sickle cell, but this is a little bit of a stream of consciousness. An article that just came out, a very fascinating article, that reviewed the efficacy mm-hmm. of substituting omega-6 for saturated fat. Now, I remember during medical school, I had a professor of cardiology, and he was very interested in nutrition. And he gave us a lecture once where he said that every day mm-hmm. I take a couple of shot glasses of corn oil.
Oh.
And this was around 1980.
Uh-huh.
And then it was in vogue to take polyunsaturated fat in lieu of saturated fat. The saturated was bad. Polyunsaturated was good. So
it's still in vogue.
I know. Yeah. It hasn't died out. But this strategy was mm-hmm. actually evaluated in a recent study. I'm going to talk about it on the weekend show, I think,
mm-hmm.
Where they substituted saturated fat, which you would get from steak mm-hmm. or any kind of fatty meat, like the skin that people laboriously take off their chicken is loaded with saturated fat. And substituting that with omega-6 oil was not beneficial in terms of reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease, which is the reason why people, cut your saturated fat, have skim milk, make sure that you use, you know, polyunsaturated oils.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Bad idea.
Yeah, very bad idea.
So first, get the omega-6 out for this sickling dad here.
Yeah.
He's a chef.
He's a chef.
He's gonna be able to prepare wonderful, uh-huh. creative dishes using this concept.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, chefs unfortunately succumb to the dietary vogues, and he may be using too much in the way of vegetable oil.
Right, right.
Cut the
right.
vegetable oil.
Eat more wild Alaskan salmon. Eat more sardines.
Yeah, this is a tragic
baby mackerel.
It's a tragic condition, but it mm-hmm. can be ameliorated. In the future for sickle cell is that we'll actually, hopefully in the future, be able to change people's genes, create a corrective gene injected into people, so to speak, it'll then take hold and it will make normal red blood cells.
Didn't the sickle cell trait occur because it was trying to correct for
malaria?
Malaria.
Actually, so it's interesting. You think of nature as, well, nature made a mistake. Why would they put people through this horrible suffering? In Africa, malaria continues to be, but used to be endemic. And
there were a few cases found in the Caribbean, which is kind of scary. That
right.
was recent.
Oh, it's coming back. But yeah. here's the thing. The sickle cell trait mm-hmm. was designed to help protect the red blood cell from the malaria, which is a parasite that infects red blood cells. So Africans in general, are very resistant to malaria. That's actually the basis of slavery, because when they first tried to colonize the Americas, mm-hmm. Malaria had actually not made it to the Americas, but we brought it, our ancestors brought it to the New World, and they tried to enslave the Indians to work in the sugarcane fields, and they died in droves. And they said, okay, well, let's bring some Europeans over. There's always Europeans who are very poor, and they thought, let's bring them from Scotland or Scandinavia or England. Uh-huh. And they put them to work in the fields, and they just died, like three-quarters of them died from malaria and tropical diseases. So then they said, gee, we notice that when we get these African then slaves, and we bring them over, they're very resistant to malaria. They're ideal slaves. And that was the basis of this, because they could work
wow.
in those tropical conditions because they already had been genetically resistant mm-hmm. to that. But with that genetic resistance comes a downside, which is the susceptibility to sickle cell. Also, people who have G6PD deficiency. That's another
yes.
type of deficiency that we see. People who have intolerance to fava beans. They cannot take high doses of intravenous vitamin C. It's an uncommon trait, but it's common enough that we test for it before we give intravenous vitamin C. That's also a malaria-resistant trait. So, you know, malaria used
That's
to be very... It was very common mm-hmm. in large swaths of the world. There was malaria in Washington, D.C., in Philadelphia. There was malaria. It's something where the mosquitoes can't survive a cold winter. So it didn't usually go so far north as New York, Boston. But much of the United States was a malarial miasma. Rome, the founding of Rome, was based on draining the Pontine swamps, which were malarial miasmas where, you know, people would go try to live in Rome and they would all get malaria and
wow.
die.
Wow.
So this is still a big problem. All right, what we're going to do is we're going to conclude this first part of our Q&A with Layla, and when we return, we're going to have part two of Q&A with Layla and continue with your questions. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.